thinking that... It wasn't I who killed her, I'll swear that. I've been in the most awful stew. To have chosen that night of all others, God, it's been awful.
Poirot said, Oh, yes, you must have had uneasy moments. But now that the truth has come out, you may be able to help us. Was Mrs. Doyle alive or dead when you stole the pearls?
Tim said hoarsely, I don't know. Honest to God, Mr. Poirot, I don't know. I'd found out where she put them at night, on the little table by the bed. I crept in, felt very softly on the table, grabbed them, put down the others and crept out again. I assumed, of course, that she was asleep.
Did you hear her breathing? Surely you would have listened for that?
Tim thought earnestly.
Oh, it was very still indeed. No, I can't remember actually hearing her breathe.
Was there any smell of smoke lingering in the air, as there would have been if a firearm had been discharged recently?
I don't think so. I don't remember it. Poirot sighed.
Oh, then we are no further.
Tim asked curiously, Who was it saw me?
Rosalie Otterbourne. She came round from the other side of the boat and saw you leave Lynette Doyle's cabin and go to your own.
So it was she who told you? Poirot said gently.
Excuse me? She did not tell me.
But then, how do you know?
Because I am Hercule Poirot. I do not need to be told. When I taxed her with it, you know what she said? She said, I saw nobody. And she lied.
But why? Poirot said in a detached voice.
Perhaps because she thought that the man she saw was the murderer. It looked like that, you know.
Well, that seems to me all the more reason for telling you. Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
She did not think so, it seems.
Tim said, a queer note in his voice. She's an extraordinary sort of a girl. She must have been through a pretty rough time with that mother of hers.
Oh, yes. Life has not been easy for her.
Poor kid, Tim muttered. Then he looked towards Race. Well, sir, where do we go from here? I admit taking the pearls from Lynette's cabin, and you'll find them just where you say they are. I'm guilty, all right, but as far as Miss Southwood is concerned, I'm not admitting anything. You've no evidence whatever against her. How I got hold of the fake necklace is my own business. Poirot murmured.
A very correct attitude.
Tim said with a flash of humour, Always the gentleman.
He added,
But perhaps you can imagine how annoying it was to me to find my mother cottoning on to you. I'm not a sufficiently hardened criminal to enjoy sitting cheek by jowl with a successful detective just before bringing off a rather risky coup. Some people might get a kick out of it. I didn't. Frankly, it gave me cold feet.
But he did not deter you from making your attempt.
Tim shrugged his shoulders. Well, I couldn't funk it to that extent. The exchange had to be made sometime, and I'd got a unique opportunity on this boat. A cabin only 2 doors off, and Lynette herself so preoccupied with her own troubles that she wasn't likely to detect the change.
I wonder if that was so.
Tim looked up sharply. What do you mean?
Poirot pressed the bell. I'm going to ask Miss Otterbourne if she will come here for a minute.
Tim frowned, but said nothing. A steward came, received the order, and went away with the message. Rosalie came after a few minutes. Her eyes reddened with recent weeping, widened a little at seeing Tim, but her old attitude of suspicion and defiance seemed entirely absent. She sat down, and with a new docility, looked from Race to Poirot.
We're very sorry to bother you, Miss Otterbourne,
said Race gently. He was slightly annoyed with Poirot. The girl said in a low voice,
It doesn't matter.
Poirot said,
It is necessary to clear up one or two points. When I asked you whether you saw anyone on the starboard deck at 1:10 this morning, your answer was that you saw nobody. Fortunately, I have been able to arrive at the truth without your help. Mr. Allerton has admitted that he was in Lynette Doyle's cabin last night.
She flashed a swift glance at Tim. Tim, his face grim and set, gave a curt nod.
The time is correct, Mr. Allerton?
Allerton replied, Quite correct. Rosalie was staring at him. Her lips trembled and fell apart. But you didn't... You didn't... He said quickly, No, I didn't kill her. I am a thief, not a murderer. It's all going to come out, so you might as well know. I was after her pearls. Poirot said,
Mr. Allerton's story is that he went to a cabin last night and exchanged a string of fake pearls for the real ones. Did you?
Said Rosalie.
Her eyes, grave, sad, childlike, questioned his.
Yes, said Tim.
There was a pause. Colonel Race shifted restlessly. Poirot said in a curious voice,
That, as I say, is Mr. Allerton's story, partially confirmed by your evidence. That is to say, there is evidence that he did visit Lynette Doyle's cabin last night, but there is no evidence to show why he did so.
Tim stared at him.
But you know.
What do I know?
Well, you know I've got the pearls.
Oh, mais oui, mais oui. I know you have the pearls, but I do not know when you got them. It may have been before last night. You said just now that Lynette Doyle would not have noticed the substitution. I'm not so sure of that. Supposing she did notice it. Supposing even she knew who did it. Supposing that last night she threatened to expose the whole business and that you knew she meant to do so. And supposing that you overheard the scene in the saloon between Jacqueline de Belfort and Simon Doyle, and as soon as the saloon was empty, you slipped in and secured the pistol, and then an hour later, when the boat had quieted down, you crept along to Lynette Doyle's cabin and made quite sure that no exposure would come.
My God, said Tim. Out of his ashen face, two tortured, agonized eyes gazed dumbly at Hercule Poirot. The latter went on.
But somebody else saw you. The girl, Louise. The next day she came to you and blackmailed you. You must pay her handsomely or she would tell what she knew. You realized that to submit to blackmail would be the beginning of the end. You pretended to agree, made an appointment to come to her cabin just before lunch with the money. Then, when she was counting the notes, you stabbed her. But again, luck was against you. Somebody saw you go to her cabin.
He half turned to Rosalie.
Your mother. So once again you had to act, huh? Dangerously, foolhardily, but it was the only chance. You heard Pennington talk about his revolver. You rushed into his cabin. You got hold of it, listened outside Dr. Bessner's cabin door, and shot Mrs. Audubon before she could reveal your name.
No! Cried Rosalie.
He didn't! And after that, you did the only thing you could do, rushed around the stern, and when I rushed after you, you had turned and pretended to be coming in the opposite direction. You had handled the revolver in gloves. Those gloves were in your pocket when I asked for them.
Tim said, Before God, I swear it isn't true, not a word of it. But his voice, ill-assured and trembling, failed to convince. It was then that Rosalie Otterbourne surprised them.
Of course it isn't true. And Monsieur Poirot knows it isn't. He's saying it for some reason of his own.
Poirot looked at her. A faint smile came to his lips. He spread out his hands in token of surrender.
Oh, mademoiselle is too clever. But you agree it was a good case.
What the devil?
Tim began with rising anger, but Poirot held up a hand.
There is a very good case against you, Mr. Allerton. I wanted you to realize that. But now I will tell you something more pleasant. I have not yet examined that rosary in your cabin. It may be that when I do, I shall find nothing there. And then, since Mademoiselle Otterbourne sticks to it that she saw no one on the deck last night, eh bien, there is no case against you at all. The pearls were taken by a kleptomaniac who has since returned them. They are in a little box on the table by the door, if you would care to examine them with Mademoiselle.
Tim got up. He stood for a moment unable to speak. When he did, his words seemed inadequate, but it is possible that they satisfied his listeners.
Thanks, he said. You won't have to give me another chance.
He held the door open for the girl. She passed out, and picking up the little cardboard box, he followed her. Side by side they went. Tim opened the box, took out the sham string of pearls, and hurled it far from him into the Nile. There, he said. That's gone. When I return the box to Poirot, the real string will be in it.
What a damned fool I've been.
Rosalie said in a low voice, Why did you come to do it in the first place? How did I come to start, do you mean? Oh, I don't know. Boredom, laziness. The fun of the thing. Such a more attractive way of earning a living than just pegging away at a job. Sounds pretty sordid to you, I expect, but you know, there was an attraction about it. Mainly the risk, I suppose.
I think I understand.
Oh, yes, but you would never do it. Rosalie considered for a moment or two, her grave young head bent.
No,
she said simply.
I wouldn't.
He said, oh, my dear, you're so lovely, so utterly lovely. Why wouldn't you say you'd seen me last night? Rosalie said,
I thought they might suspect you.
Did you suspect me?
No. I couldn't believe that you'd kill anyone.
No, I'm not the strong stuff murderers are made of. I'm only a miserable sneak thief. She put out a timid hand and touched his arm.
Don't say that.
He caught her hand in his.
Rosalie, would you?
You know what I mean? Or would you always despise me and throw it in my teeth? She smiled faintly.
Well, there are things you could throw in my teeth, too.
Rosalie, darling. But she held back a minute longer.
This Joanna?
Tim gave a sudden shout.
Oh, Joanna! You're as bad as Mother. I don't care a damn about Joanna. She's got a face like a horse and a predatory eye. A most unattractive female.
Presently, Rosalie said,
Your mother need never know about you.
Tim said thoughtfully, I'm not sure. I think I shall tell her. Mother's got plenty of stuffing, you know. She can stand up to things. Yes, I think I shall shatter her maternal illusions about me. She'll be so relieved to know that my relations with Joanna were purely of a business nature that she'll forgive me everything else. They had come to Mrs. Allerton's cabin, and Tim knocked firmly on the door. It opened, and Mrs. Allerton stood on the threshold. Rosalie and I, said Tim. He paused.
Oh, my dears, said Mrs. Allerton.
She folded Rosalie in her arms.
Oh, my dear, dear child. I'd always hoped, but Tim was so tiresome and pretended he didn't like you. But of course I saw through that.
Rosalie said in a broken voice,
You've been so sweet to me, always. I used to wish...
She broke off and sobbed happily on Mrs. Allerton's shoulder. Chapter 28 As the door closed behind Tim and Rosalie, Poirot looked somewhat apologetically at Colonel Race. The Colonel was looking rather grim.
"'You will consent to my little arrangement, yes?'
Poirot pleaded.
"'It is irregular, I know it is irregular, yes. But I have a high regard for human happiness.'
"'You have none for mine,' said Race.
"'That jeune fille, I have a tenderness towards her. She loves that man.' It will be an excellent match. She has the stiffening he needs. The mother likes her. Everything is thoroughly suitable.
In fact, the marriage has been arranged by Heaven and Hercule Poirot. All I have to do is to compound a felony.
Oh, but mon ami, I told you it was all conjecture on my part.
Race grinned suddenly.
It's all right by me, he said. I'm not a damn policeman, thank God. I dare say the young fool goes straight enough now. Well, the girl's straight, all right. No, what I'm complaining of is your treatment of me. I'm a patient man, but there are limits to my patience. Do you know who committed the 3 murders on this boat, or don't you?
I do.
Then why all this beating about the bush?
Huh, you think that I am just amusing myself with side issues? And it annoys you? But it is not that. Once I went professionally to an archaeological expedition, and I learned something there. In the course of an excavation, when something comes up out of the ground, everything is cleared away very carefully around it. You take away the loose earth, and you scrape here and there with a knife, until finally your object is there, all alone, ready to be drawn and photographed, with no extraneous matter confusing it. That is what I have been seeking to do. Clear away the extraneous matter so that we can see the truth, the naked, shining truth.
Good, said Race. Let's have this naked, shining truth. It wasn't Paddington, it wasn't young Allerton, I presume it wasn't Fleetwood. Let's hear who it was for a change.
My friend, I am just about to tell you.
There was a knock on the door. Race uttered a muffled curse. It was Dr. Bessner and Cornelia. The latter was looking upset.
"Oh, Colonel Race," she exclaimed. "Miss Bowers had just told me about Cousin Marie. It's been the most dreadful shock. She said she couldn't bear the responsibility all by herself any longer, and that I'd better know, as I was one of the family. I just couldn't believe it at first, but Dr. Bessner here has been just wonderful."
"Oh, no, no,"
protested the doctor modestly.
"No, he's been so kind, explaining it all, and how people really can help it. He's had kleptomaniacs in his clinic, and he's explained to me how it's very often due to a deep-seated neurosis."
Cornelia repeated the words with awe.
"It's planted very deeply in the subconscious. Sometimes it's just some little thing that happened when you were a child. And he's cured people by getting them to think back and remember what that little thing was."
Cornelia paused, drew a deep breath, and started off again.
"But it's worrying me dreadfully in case it all gets out. It would be too terrible in New York. Why, all the tabloids would have it. Cousin Marie and Mother and everybody, they'd never hold up their heads again."
Race sighed.
"That's all right," he said. "This is hush-hush house."
"I beg your pardon, Colonel Race?"
"No, what I was endeavouring to say was that anything short of murder is being hushed up."
"Oh!"
Cornelia clasped her hands.
"I'm so relieved! I've just been worrying and worrying!"
"You have the heart too tender,"
said Dr. Bessner, and patted her benevolently on the shoulder. He said to the others, "She has a very sensitive and beautiful nature."
"Oh, I haven't really. You're too kind."
Poirot murmured.
"Have you seen any more of Mr. Ferguson?"
Cornelia blushed.
"No, but Cousin Marie's been talking about him."
"It seems the young man is highly born," said Dr. Bessner. "I must confess, it does not look like it. His clothes are terrible. Not for a moment does he appear a well-bred man."
"And what do you think, mademoiselle?"
"Well, I think he must be just plain crazy," said Cornelia. Poirot turned to the doctor.
"How is your patient?"
"Ah, he's going on splendidly. I have just reassured the little Fraulein de Belfort. Would you believe it? I found her in despair. Just because the fellow had a bit of a temperature this afternoon, what could be more natural? It is amazing that he is not in a high fever now. But no, he is like some of our peasants. He has a magnificent constitution, the constitution of an ox. I have seen them with deep wounds that they hardly notice. It is the same with Mr. Doyle. His pulse is steady, his temperature only slightly above normal. I was able to pooh-pooh the little lady's fears. All the same, it is ridiculous, nicht wahr? One minute you shoot a man, the next you are in hysterics in case he may not be doing well."
Cornelia said,
"She loves him terribly, you see."
"Ah, but that is not sensible, Dad. If you loved a man, would you try to shoot him, eh? No, you are sensible."
"I don't like things that go off with bangs, anyway," said Cornelia.
"Naturally, you do not. You are very feminine."
Race interrupted this scene of heavy approval.
"Since Doyle is all right, there's no reason I shouldn't come along and resume our talk of this afternoon. He was just telling me about a telegram."
Dr. Bessner's bulk moved up and down appreciatively.
"It was very funny, then. Doyle, he tells me about it, yes? He wants a telegram all about the vegetables, potatoes, artichokes, leeks." "Pardon?"
With a stifled exclamation, Race had sat up in his chair.
"My God," he said. "So that's it. Ricchetti."
He looked around on three uncomprehending faces.
"A new code. It was used in the South African rebellion. Potatoes mean machine guns, artichokes are high explosives, and so on. Ricchetti is no more an archaeologist than I am. He's a very dangerous agitator. A man who's killed more than once, and I'll swear that he's killed once again. Mrs. Doyle opened that telegram by mistake, you see. If she were ever to repeat what was in it before me, he knew his goose would be cooked."
He turned to Poirot.
"Am I right?"
he said.
"Is Ricchetti the man?"
"He is your man," said Poirot. "I always thought there was something wrong about him. He was almost too word-perfect in his role. He was all archaeologist, not enough human being."
He paused and then said,
"But it was not Ricchetti who killed Lynette Doyle. For some time now I have known what I may express as the first half of the murder. Now I know the second half also. The picture is complete. But you understand that although I know what must have happened, I have no proof that it happened. Intellectually, the case is satisfying. Actually, it is profoundly unsatisfactory. There is only one hope, a confession from the murderer."
Dr. Bessner raised his shoulders skeptically.
But that, it would be a miracle.
I think not. Not under the circumstances.
Cornelia cried out.
But who is it? Aren't you going to tell us?
Poirot's eyes ranged quietly over the three of them. Race, smiling sardonically, Bessner, still looking sceptical, Cornelia, her mouth hanging a little open, gazing at him with eager eyes.
Oh, mais oui,
he said.
I like an audience, I must confess. I am vain, you see. I am puffed up with conceit. I like to say, see how clever is Hercule Poirot.
Race shifted a little in his chair.
Well, he said gently, just how clever is Hercule Poirot?
Shaking his head sadly from side to side, Poirot said,
Well, to begin with, I was stupid, incredibly stupid. To me, the stumbling block was the pistol, Jacqueline de Belfort's pistol. Why had that pistol not been left on the scene of the crime? The idea of the murderer was quite plainly to incriminate her. Why, then, did the murderer take it away? I was so stupid that I thought of all sorts of fantastic reasons. The real one was very simple. The murderer took it away because he had to take it away, because he had no choice in the matter.
Chapter 29
You and I, my friend,
Poirot leaned towards Race,
started our investigation with a preconceived idea. That idea was that a crime was committed on the spur of the moment without any preliminary planning. Somebody wished to remove Lynette Doyle and had seized their opportunity to do so at a moment when the crime would almost certainly be attributed to Jacqueline de Belfort. It therefore followed that a person in question had overheard the scene between Jacqueline and Simon Doyle and had obtained possession of the pistol after the others had left the saloon. But, my friends, if that preconceived idea was wrong, the whole aspect of the case altered. And it was wrong. This was no spontaneous crime committed on the spur of the moment. It was, on the contrary, very carefully planned and accurately timed, with all the details meticulously worked out beforehand, even to the drugging of Hercule Poirot's bottle of wine on the night in question.
Oh, yes, that is so.
I was put to sleep so that there should be no possibility of my participating in the events of the night. It did just occur to me as a possibility. I drink wine. My two companions at table drink whiskey and mineral water, respectively. Nothing easier than to slip a dose of harmless narcotic into my bottle of wine. The bottle stand on the tables all day. But I dismissed the thought. It had been a hot day. I had been unusually tired. It was not really extraordinary that I should for once have slept heavily instead of lightly, as I usually do. You see, I was still in the grip of the preconceived idea. If I had been drugged, that would have implied premeditation. It would mean that before 7:30, when dinner is served, the crime had already been decided upon. And that, always from the point of view of the preconceived idea, was absurd. The first blow to the preconceived idea was when the pistol was recovered from the Nile. To begin with, if we were right in our assumptions, the pistol ought never to have been thrown overboard at all. And there was more to follow.
Poirot turned to Dr. Bessner.
You, Dr. Bessner, examined Lynette Doyle's body. You will remember that the wound showed signs of scorching. That is to say that the pistol had been placed close against the head before being fired?
Bessner nodded.
So, that is exact.
But when the pistol was found, it was wrapped in a velvet stole. And that velvet showed definite signs that the pistol had been fired through its folds, presumably under the impression that that would deaden the sound of the shot. But if the pistol had been fired through the velvet, there would have been no signs of burning on the victim's skin. Therefore, the shot fired through the stole could not have been the shot that killed Lynette Doyle. Could it have been the other shot, the one fired by Jacqueline de Belfort at Simon Doyle? Again, no. For there had been two witnesses of that shooting, and we knew all about it. It appeared, therefore, as though a third shot had been fired. One we knew nothing about. But only two shots had been fired from the pistol, so there was no hint or suggestion of another shot. Here we were, face to face, with a very curious, unexplained circumstance. The next interesting point
was the fact that in Lynette Doyle's cabin I found 2 bottles of coloured nail polish. Now, ladies very often vary the colour of their nails, but so far, Lynette Doyle's nails had always been the shade called Cardinal, a deep, dark red. The other bottle was labelled Rose, which is a shade of pale pink, but the few drops remaining in the bottle were not pale pink, but a bright red. I was sufficiently curious to take out a stopper and sniff. Instead of the usual strong odor of pear drops, the bottle smelt of vinegar. That is to say, it suggested that a drop or two of fluid in it was red ink. Now, there is no reason why Mrs. Doyle should not have had a bottle of red ink. But it would have been more natural if she had had red ink in a red ink bottle and not in a nail polish bottle. It suggested a link with a faintly stale handkerchief, which had been wrapped around the pistol. Red ink washes out quickly, but it always leaves a pale pink stain. I should perhaps have arrived at the truth with these slender indications, but an event occurred which rendered all doubt superfluous. Louise Bourget was killed in circumstances which pointed unmistakably to the fact that she had been blackmailing the murderer. Not only was a fragment of a 1,000-franc note still clasped in her hand, but I remembered some very significant words she had used this morning. Listen carefully, for here is the crux of the whole matter. When I asked her if she had seen anything the previous night, she gave this very curious answer. Naturally, if I had been unable to sleep, if I had mounted the stairs, then perhaps I might have seen this assassin, this monster, enter or leave Madame's cabin? Now, what exactly did that tell us?
Bessner, his nose wrinkling with intellectual interest, replied promptly.
He told you that she had mounted a stair. No. No. You fail to see the point. Why should she have said that to us?
To convey a hint.
But why hint to us? If she knows who the murderer is, there are 2 courses open to her. To tell us the truth, or to hold her tongue and demand money for her silence from the person concerned. But she does neither. She neither says promptly, I saw nobody, I was asleep. Nor does she say, oh yes, I saw someone, and it was so-and-so. Why use that significant indeterminate rigmarole of words?
Parbleu, there can be only one reason. She is hinting to the murderer. Therefore, the murderer must have been present at the time. But besides myself and Colonel Reyes, only 2 people were present. Simon Doyle and Dr. Bessner.
The doctor sprang up with a roar.
Ah! What is it that you say? You accuse me? Again? That is ridiculous! Beneath contempt!
Poirot said sharply,
be quiet! I am telling you what I thought at the time. Let us remain impersonal.
He doesn't mean he thinks it's you now, said Cornelia soothingly.
Poirot went on quickly.
So it lay there, between Simon Doyle and Dr. Bessner. But what reason had Bessner to kill Lynette Doyle?
None, so far as I know.
Simon Doyle, then?
No, but that was impossible.
There were plenty of witnesses who could swear that Doyle never left the saloon that evening until the quarrel broke out. After that, he was wounded, and it would then have been physically impossible for him to have done so.
Had I good evidence on both these points?
Yes, I had the evidence of Miss Robson, of Jim Fanthorpe, of Jacqueline de Belfort as to the first. And I had the skilled testimony of Dr. Bester and of Miss Bowers as to the other. No doubt was possible. So, Dr. Bessner must be the guilty one. In favor of this theory, there was the fact that a maid had been stabbed with a surgical knife. On the other hand, Bessner had deliberately called attention to this fact. And then, my friends, a second, perfectly indisputable fact became apparent to me. Louise Bourget's hint could not have been intended for Dr. Bessner, because she could perfectly well have spoken to him in private at any time she liked. There was one person, and one person only, who corresponded to her necessity, Simon Doyle. Simon Doyle was wounded, was constantly attended by a doctor, was in that doctor's cabin. It was to him, therefore, that she risked saying those ambiguous words in case she might not get another chance. And I remember how she had gone on, turning to him. Monsieur, I implore you, you see how it is. What can I say? And his answer, oh, my good girl, don't be a fool. Nobody thinks you saw or heard anything. You'll be quite all right. I'll look after you. Nobody's accusing you of anything. That was the assurance she wanted. And she got it.
Bessner uttered a colossal snort.
Ah, it is foolish, that. Do you think a man with a fractured bone and a splint on his leg could go walking about a boat and stabbing people? I tell you, it was impossible for Simon Doyle to leave his cabin.
Poirot said gently, I know, that is quite true. The whole thing was impossible. It was impossible, but it was also true. There could be only one logical meaning behind Louise Bourget's words.
So I returned to the beginning and reviewed the crime in the light of this new knowledge. Was it possible that in the period preceding the quarrel, Simon Doyle had left the saloon and the others had forgotten or not noticed it?
I could not see that that was possible.
Could a skilled testimony of Dr. Bessner and Miss Bowers be disregarded? Again, I felt sure it could not. But I remembered there was a gap between the two. Simon Doyle had been alone in the saloon for a period of 5 minutes, and the skilled testimony of Dr. Bessner only applied to the time after that period. For that period, we had only the evidence of visual appearance. And though, apparently, that was perfectly sound, it was no longer certain. What had actually been seen? Leaving assumption out of the question.
Miss Robson had seen Miss de Belfort fire her pistol, had seen Simon Doyle collapse onto a chair, had seen him clasp a handkerchief to his leg, and seen that handkerchief gradually soak through red. What had Mr. Fanthorpe heard and seen? He had heard a shot. He found Doyle with a red-stained handkerchief clasped to his leg. What had happened then? Doyle had been very insistent that Miss de Belfort should be got away, that she should not be left alone. After that, he suggested that Fanthorpe should get hold of the doctor.
Accordingly, Miss Robson and Mr. Fanthorpe go out with Mr. Belfort, and for the next 5 minutes they are busy on the port side of the deck.
Miss Bowers's, Dr. Bessner's, and Mr. Belfort's cabins are all on the port side. 2 minutes are all that Simon Doyle needs. He picks up the pistol from under the sofa, slips out of his shoes, runs like a hare silently along the starboard deck, enters his wife's cabin, creeps up to her as she lies asleep, shoots her through the head, puts the bottle that has contained the red ink on her washstand, it mustn't be found on him, runs back, gets hold of Miss Van Schuyler's velvet stole, which he has quietly stuffed down the side of a chair in readiness, muffles it round the pistol, and fires a bullet into his leg. His chair, into which he falls, in genuine agony this time, is by a window. He lifts the window and throws the pistol, wrapped up with a telltale handkerchief in the velvet stole, into the Nile.
Impossible, said Race.
No, my friend, not impossible. Remember the evidence of Tim Allerton? He heard a pop, followed by a splash, and he heard something else, the footsteps of a man running past his door.
But nobody could have been running along the starboard side of the deck.
What he heard was the stockinged feet of Simon Doyle running past his cabin.
Race said, I still say it's impossible. No man could work out the whole caboodle like that in a flash, especially a chap like Doyle who's slow in his mental processes.
But very quick and deft in his physical actions.
Well, that, yes, but he wouldn't be capable of thinking the whole thing out.
But he did not think it out himself, my friend.
No, that is where we were all wrong.
It looked like a crime committed on the spur of the moment, but it was not a crime committed on the spur of the moment. As I say, it was a very cleverly planned and well-thought-out piece of work. It could not be chance that Simon Doyle had a bottle of red ink in his pocket.
No,
it must be design.
It was not chance that he had a plain, unmarked handkerchief with him. It was not chance that Jacqueline de Belfort's foot kicked the pistol under the settee, where it would be out of sight and unremembered until later. Jacqueline, certainly. The two halves of the murderer.
What gave Simon his alibi?
the shot fired by Jacqueline. What gave Jacqueline her alibi? The insistence of Simon, which resulted in a hospital nurse remaining with her all night. There. Between the two of them, you get all the qualities you require. The cool, resourceful, planning brain, Jacqueline de Belfort's brain, and the man of action to carry it out with incredible swiftness and timing. Look at it the right way, and it answers every question. Simon Doyle and Jacqueline had been lovers. Realize that they are still lovers, and it is all clear. Simon does away with his rich wife, inherits her money, and in due course will marry his old love. It was all very ingenious. The persecution of Mrs. Doyle by Jacqueline, all part of the plan. Simon's pretended rage. And yet, there were lapses. He held forth to me once about possessive women, held forth with real bitterness. It ought to have been clear to me that it was his wife he was thinking about, not Jacqueline. Then his manner to his wife in public. An ordinary, inarticulate Englishman such as Simon Doyle is very embarrassed of showing any affection. Simon was not a really good actor. He overdid a devoted manner. That conversation I had with Mademoiselle Jacqueline, too, when she pretended that somebody had overheard. I saw no one, and there was no one. But it was to be a useful red herring later. Then, one night, on this boat, I thought I heard Simon and Lynette outside my cabin. He was saying, "We've got to go through with it now." It was Doyle, all right, but it was to Jacqueline he was speaking. The final drama was perfectly planned and timed. There was a sleeping draught for me in case I might put an inconvenient finger in the pie. There was a selection of Miss Robson as a witness, the working up of the scene, Mr. Belfort's exaggerated remorse and hysterics. She made a good deal of noise in case the shot should be heard. En vérité, it was an extraordinary clever idea. Jacqueline says she has shot Doyle, Miss Robson says so, Fanstop says so, and when Simon's leg is examined, he has been shot. It looks unanswerable. For both of them, there is a perfect alibi. At the cost, it is true, of a certain amount of pain and risk to Simon Doyle, but it is necessary that his wound should definitely disable him. And then the plan goes wrong. Louise Bourget has been wakeful. She has come up the stairway. She has seen Simon Doyle run along to his wife's cabin and come back. Easy enough to piece together what has happened the following day. And so she makes her greedy bid for hush money. And in so doing, signs her death warrant.
But Mr. Doyle couldn't have killed her, Cornelia objected.
No. The other partner did that murder. As soon as he could, Simon Doyle asks to see Jacqueline. He even asks me to leave them alone together. He tells her then of the new danger. They must act at once. He knows where Bessner's scalpels are kept. After the crime, the scalpel is wiped and returned. And then, very late and rather out of breath, Jacqueline de Belfort hurries into lunch. And still, all is not well. For Mrs. Otterbourne has seen Jacqueline go into Louise Bourget's cabin. And she comes hot-foot to tell Simon about it. Jacqueline is a murderess. Do you remember how Simon shouted at the poor woman? Nerves, we thought, eh? But the door was open, and he was trying to convey the danger to his accomplice. She heard, and she acted like lightning. She remembered Pennington had talked about a revolver. She got hold of it, crept up outside the door, listened, and at a critical moment, fired. She boasted once that she was a good shot, and her boast was not an idle one. I remarked, after that third crime, that there were three ways the murderer could have gone. Huh? I meant that he could have gone aft, in which case Tim Allerton was the criminal. He could have gone over the side, very improbable, or he could have gone into a cabin. Jacqueline's cabin was just two away from Dr. Bessner's. She had only to throw down the revolver, bolt into the cabin, ruffle her hair, and fling herself down on the bunk. It was risky, but it was the only possible chance. There was a silence. Then Race asked, "What happened to the first bullet fired at Doyle by the girl?"
"I think it went into the table. There is a recently made hole there. I think Doyle had time to dig it out with a penknife and fling it through the window. He had, of course, a spare cartridge, so that it would appear that only two shots had been fired.
Cornelia sighed.
They thought of everything, she said. It's horrible.
Poirot was silent, but it was not a modest silence. His eyes seemed to be saying, "You are wrong. They didn't allow for Hercule Poirot."
Aloud, he said, "And now, Doctor, we will go and have a word with your patient."
Chapter 30 It was very much later that evening that Hercule Poirot came and knocked on the door of the cabin. A voice said, "Come in," and he entered. Jacqueline de Belfort was sitting in a chair. In another chair, close against the wall, sat the big stewardess. Jacqueline's eyes surveyed Poirot thoughtfully. She made a gesture towards the stewardess.
"Can she go?"
Poirot nodded to the woman and she went out. Poirot drew up a chair and sat down near Jacqueline. Neither of them spoke. Poirot's face was unhappy. In the end, it was the girl who spoke first.
"Well?"
she said.
"It's all over. You were too clever for us, Monsieur Poirot."
Poirot sighed. He spread out his hands. He seemed strangely dumb.
"All the same," said Jacqueline reflectively, "I can't really see that you had much proof. You were quite right, of course, but if we'd bluffed you out..."
"In no other way, mademoiselle, could a thing have happened."
"Well, that's proof enough for a logical mind, but I don't believe it would have convinced a jury." "Oh, well, it can't be helped. You sprang it all on Simon, and he went down like a ninepin. He just lost his head utterly, poor lamb, and admitted everything."
She shook her head.
"He's a bad loser."
"But you, mademoiselle, are a good loser."
She laughed suddenly, a queer, gay, defiant little laugh.
"Oh, yes, I'm a good loser, all right."
She looked at him. She said suddenly and impulsively,
"Oh, don't mind so much, Monsieur Poirot, about me, I mean." "You do mind, don't you?"
"Yes, mademoiselle."
"But it wouldn't have occurred to you to let me off?"
Hercule Poirot said quietly,
"Non."
She nodded her head in quiet agreement.
"No, look, it's no use being sentimental. I might do it again. I'm not a safe person any longer. I can feel that myself."
She went on broodingly,
"It's so dreadfully easy, killing people. And you begin to feel that it doesn't matter, that it's only you that matters. It's dangerous, that."
She paused, then said with a little smile,
"You did your best for me, you know. That night at Aswan, you told me not to open my heart to evil. Did you realize then what was in my mind?"
He shook his head.
"I only know that what I said was true."
"Yes, it was true. I could have stopped then, you know. I nearly did. I could have told Simon that I wouldn't go on with it. But then, perhaps..."
She broke off. She said,
"Would you like to hear about it? From the beginning?"
"If you care to tell me, mademoiselle."
"I think I want to tell you. It was all very simple, really. You see, Simon and I loved each other."
It was a matter-of-fact statement, yet underneath the lightness of her tone, there were echoes. Poirot said simply,
"And for you, love would have been enough, but not for him."
"Oh, yes, you might put it that way, perhaps. But you don't quite understand, Simon. You see, he's always wanted money so dreadfully. He likes all the things you get with money, horses and yachts and sport, nice things, all of them, things a man ought to be keen about, and he'd never been able to have any of them. He's awfully simple, Simon is. He wants things just like a child wants them, you know, terribly. All the same, he never tried to marry anybody rich and horrid. He wasn't that sort. And then we met, and that sort of settled things. Only we didn't see when we'd be able to marry. He'd had rather a decent job, but he had lost it. In a way, it was his own fault. He tried to do something smart over money and got found out at once. But I don't believe he really meant to be dishonest. He just thought it was the sort of thing people did in the city."
A flicker passed over her listener's face, but he guarded his tongue.
"There we were, up against it. And then I thought of Lynette and her new country house, and I rushed off to her. You know, Monsieur Poirot, I loved Lynette, really I did. She was my best friend, and I never dreamed that anything was ever going to come between us. I just thought how lucky it was she was rich. It might make all the difference to me and Simon if she'd give him a job. And she was awfully sweet about it, and told me to bring Simon down to see her. It was about then you saw us that night at Chez Ma Tante. We were making whoopee, although we couldn't really afford it.
She paused, sighed, then went on.
What I'm going to say now is quite true, Monsieur Poirot. Even though Lynette is dead, it doesn't alter the truth. That's why I'm not really sorry about her even now. She went all out to get Simon away from me. That's the absolute truth. I don't think she even hesitated for more than about a minute. I was her friend, but she didn't care. She just went bold-headed for Simon. And Simon didn't care a damn about her. I talked a lot to you about glamour, but of course that wasn't true. He didn't want Lynette. He thought her good-looking, but terribly bossy, and he hated bossy women. The whole thing embarrassed him frightfully. But he did like the thought of her money. Of course, I saw that. And at last I suggested to him that it might be a good thing if he got rid of me and married Lynette. But he scouted the idea. He said money or no money, it would be hell to be married to her. He said his idea of having money was to have it himself, not to have a rich wife holding the purse strings. I'd be a kind of damn prince consort, he said to me. He said, too, he didn't want anyone but me. I think I know when the idea came into his head. He said one day, if I'd any luck, I'd marry her, and she'd die in about a year and leave me all the boodle. And then a queer, startled look came into his eyes. That was when he first thought of it. He talked about it a good deal one way or another, about how convenient it would be if Lynette died. I said it was an awful idea, and then he shut up about it. Then one day I found him reading up all about arsenic. I taxed him with it. Then, and he laughed and said, "Nothing venture, nothing have." It's about the only time in my life I shall be near to touching a fat lot of money. After a bit, I saw that he'd made up his mind, and I was terrified. Simply terrified. Because, you see, I realized that he'd never pull it off. He's so childishly simple. He'd have no kind of subtlety about it, and he's got no imagination. He would probably have just bunged arsenic into her and assumed the doctor would say she'd died of gastritis. He always thought things would go right. So I had to come into it, too, to look after him.
She said it very simply, but in complete good faith. Poirot had no doubt whatever that her motive had been exactly what she said it was. She herself had not coveted Lynette Ridgway's money, but she had loved Simon Doyle, had loved him beyond reason and beyond rectitude and beyond pity.
I thought and I thought, trying to work out a plan. It seemed to me that the basis of the idea ought to be a kind of two-handed alibi. You know, if Simon and I could somehow or other give evidence against each other. But actually, that evidence would clear us of everything. It would be easy enough for me to pretend to hate Simon. It was quite a likely thing to happen under the circumstances. Then if Lynette was killed, I should probably be suspected, so it would be better if I was suspected right away. We worked out details little by little. I wanted it to be so that if anything went wrong, they'd get me and not Simon. But Simon was worried about me. The only thing I was glad about was that I hadn't got to do it. I simply couldn't have. Not go along in cold blood and kill her when she was asleep. You see, I hadn't forgiven her. I think I could have killed her face to face, but not the other way. We worked out everything carefully. Even then, Simon went and wrote a J in blood, which was a silly melodramatic thing to do. It's just the sort of thing he would think of. But it went off all right.
Poirot nodded. Yes. It was not your fault that Louise Bourget could not sleep that night. And afterwards, mademoiselle?
She met his eyes squarely.
Yes,
she said.
It's rather horrible, isn't it? I can't believe that I did that. I know now what you meant by opening your heart to evil. You know pretty well how it happened. Louise made it clear to Simon that she knew. Simon got you to bring me to him. As soon as we were alone together, he told me what had happened. He told me what I'd got to do. I wasn't even horrified. I was so afraid, so deadly afraid. That's what murder does to you. Simon and I were safe, quite safe, except for this miserable blackmailing French girl. I took her all the money we could get hold of. I pretended to grovel. And then, when she was counting the money, I did it. It was quite easy. That's what's so horribly, horribly frightening about it. It's so terribly easy. And even then we weren't safe. Mrs. Otterborn had seen me. She came triumphantly along the deck, looking for you and Colonel Race. Well, I'd no time to think. I just acted like a flash. It was almost exciting. I knew it was touch or go that time, and that seemed to make it better.
She stopped again.
Do you remember when you came into my cabin afterwards? You said you were not sure why you had come. I was so miserable, so terrified. I thought Simon was going to die.
And I was hoping it, said Poirot.
Jacqueline nodded.
Yes, it would have been better for him that way.
But that was not my thought.
Jacqueline looked at the sternness of his face. She said,
Oh, don't mind so much for me, Monsieur Poirot. After all, I've lived hard always, you know. If we'd won out, I'd have been very happy and enjoyed things and probably should never have regretted anything. As it is, well, one goes through with it.
She added,
I suppose the stewardess is in attendance to see I don't hang myself or swallow a miraculous capsule of prussic acid like people always do in books. Well, you needn't be afraid. I shan't do that. It will be easier for Simon if I'm standing by.
Poirot got up. Jacqueline rose also. She said with a sudden smile,
Do you remember when I said I must follow my star? You said it might be a false star, and I said, That very bad star, that star fall down.
He went onto the deck with her laughter ringing in his ears. Chapter 31 It was early dawn when they came into Shellal. The rocks came down grimly to the water's edge. Poirot murmured,
Quel pays sauvage.
Race stood beside him.
Well, he said, we've done our job. I've arranged for Ricchetti to be taken ashore first. Well, glad we've got him. He's been a slippery customer, I can tell you, given us the slip dozens of times.
He went on.
Now we must get hold of a stretcher for Doyle. Remarkable how he went to pieces.
Not really, said Poirot. That boyish type of criminal is usually intensely vain. Once prick the bubble of their self-esteem and it is finished. They go to pieces like children.
Yes, deserves to be hanged, said Race. He's a cold-blooded scoundrel. Well, I'm sorry for the girl, but there's nothing to be done about it.
Poirot shook his head.
People say love justifies everything, eh? But that is not true. Women who care for men like Jacqueline cares for Simon Doyle are very dangerous. It is what I said when I saw her first. She cares too much, that little one. It is true.
Cornelia Robson came up beside him.
Oh, she said, we're nearly in.
She paused a minute or two, then said,
I've been with her.
With Miss de Belfort?
Yes, I felt it was kind of awful for her boxed up with that stewardess. Cousin Marie's very angry, though, I'm afraid.
Miss Van Schuyler was progressing slowly down the deck towards them. Her eyes were venomous.
Cornelia,
she snapped,
you've behaved outrageously. I shall send you straight home.
Cornelia took a deep breath.
I'm sorry, Cousin Marie. But I'm not going home. I'm going to get married.
Ah, so you've seen sense at last,
snapped the old lady. Ferguson came striding round the corner of the deck. He said,
Cornelia, what's this I hear? It's not true.
No, it's quite true, said Cornelia. I'm going to marry Dr. Bessner. He asked me last night.
And why are you going to marry him? Said Ferguson furiously. Simply because he's rich.
No, I'm not, said Cornelia indignantly. I like him. He's kind, and he knows a lot. And I've always been interested in sick folks and clinics, and I shall just have a wonderful life with him.
Do you mean to say, said Mr. Ferguson incredulously, that you'd rather marry that disgusting old man than me?
Yes, I would. You're not reliable. You wouldn't be at all a comfortable sort of person to live with. And he's not old. He's not 50 yet.
No, but he's got a stomach, said Mr. Ferguson venomously.
Well, I've got round shoulders, said Cornelia. What one looks like doesn't matter. He says I really could help him in his work, and he's going to teach me all about neuroses.
She moved away. Ferguson said to Poirot,
Do you think she really means that?
Certainly.
She prefers that pompous old bore to me.
Undoubtedly.
The girl's mad, said Ferguson.
Poirot's eyes twinkled.
She is a woman of an original mind, he said. It is probably the first time you have met one.
The boat drew into the landing stage. A cordon had been drawn round the passengers. They'd been asked to wait before disembarking. Ricchetti, dark-faced and sullen, was marched ashore by two engineers. Then, after a certain amount of delay, a stretcher was brought. Simon Doyle was carried along the deck to the gangway. He looked a different man, cringing, frightened. All his boyish insouciance vanished. Jacqueline de Belfort followed. A stewardess walked beside her. She was pale, but otherwise looked much as usual. She came up to the stretcher.
Hello, Simon, she said.
He looked up at her quickly. The old boyish look came back to his face for a moment.
I messed it up, he said.
Lost my head and admitted everything. I'm sorry, Jackie. I've let you down. She smiled at him. Then,
It's all right, Simon, she said.
A fool's game, and we've lost, that's all. She stood aside. The bearer picked up the handles of the stretcher.
Jacqueline bent down and tied the lace of her shoe. Then her hand went to her stocking top, and she straightened up with something in her hand. There was a sharp, explosive pop.
Simon Doyle gave one convulsed shudder, and then lay still. Jacqueline de Belfort nodded. She stood for a moment, pistol in hand. She gave a fleeting smile at Poirot. Then, as Race jumped forward, she turned the little glittering toy against her heart and pressed the trigger. She sank down in a soft, huddled heap. Race shouted,
Where the devil did she get that pistol?
Poirot felt a hand on his arm. Mrs. Allerton said softly,
You knew?
He nodded.
She had a pair of those pistols. I realized that when I heard that one had been found in Rosalie Ottoburn's handbag the day of the search. Jacqueline sat at the same table as they did. When she realized that there was going to be a search, she slipped it into the other girl's handbag. Later, she went to Rosalie's cabin and got it back, after having distracted her attention with a comparison of lipsticks. As both she and her cabin had been searched yesterday, it wasn't thought necessary to do it again.
Mrs. Allerton said,
You wanted her to take that way out?
Yes.
But she would not take it alone. That is why Simon Doyle has died an easier death than he deserved.
Mrs. Allerton shivered.
Love can be a very frightening thing.
Why? That is why most great love stories are tragedies.
Mrs. Allerton's eyes rested upon Tim and Rosalie standing side by side in the sunlight, and she said suddenly and passionately,
But thank God there is happiness in the world.
As you say, madame, thank God for it.
Presently the passengers went ashore. Later the bodies of Louise Bourget and of Mrs. Otterbourne were carried off the Carnac. Lastly, the body of Lynette Doyle was brought ashore, and all over the world wires began to hum, telling the public that Lynette Doyle, who had been Lynette Ridgway, the famous, the beautiful, the wealthy Lynette Doyle, was dead. Sir George Wode read about it in his London club, and Sterndale Rockford in New York, and Joanna Southwood in Switzerland, and it was discussed in the bar of the Three Crowns in Malton-under-Wode. And Mr. Burnaby's lean friend said,
Well, it didn't seem fair, her having everything.
And Mr. Burnaby said acutely, Well, it doesn't seem to have done her much good, poor lass. But after a while they stopped talking about her, and discussed instead who was going to win the Grand National. For, as Mr. Ferguson was saying at that minute in Luxor, it is not the past that matters, but the future.
We hope you have enjoyed Death on the Nile by Agatha Christie, performed by David Suchet. Death on the Nile text copyright 1937, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 1992, Chivers Press Limited. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.